Welcome to Imperfect Leaders, a podcast showcasing the country's most inspirational leaders who are all willing to be vulnerable and share important life lessons with the rest of us. After all, there's no such thing as a perfect leader. Today's guest, Jason Karp, is the founder of a cool venture called HumanCo that invests in game-changing brands in the health and wellness space. My personal favorites are True Food Kitchen, Cosmic Bliss, and Snow Days, all delicious. Jason has an incredible story. It's a true hero's journey. Many times during his life, he has stared directly into the abyss, suffered serious psychological and physical challenges, and emerged every single time as a more authentic, self-aware, and resilient leader. So sit back and enjoy today's conversation with my new friend, Jason Karp.
I'm very concerned about the state of humanity. Mm-hmm. We're the sickest we've ever been in recorded human history. We're the first generation in human history that is expected to live a shorter lifespan than our previous. And we wanted to, in HumanCo, basically create a next generation kind of company that put people's health and the planet first, with trying to make money second. Mm-hmm. And the way we're structured is that we build brands from scratch, like my family and I did with Hugh Kitchen. We buy brands, all within the health and wellness space. We buy brands that are consistent with a healthier lifestyle. And we also invest in brands or companies where we don't necessarily own the whole thing, as is the case with True Food Kitchen. And Oprah was a proud investor well before we got involved. But the goal is finding companies that really have a strong mission, a strong North Star about how they focus on the human and how they focus on the person and the person's health and the person's journey, and do it in a way that is not profit maximizing. Mm-hmm. And the reason we call it HumanCo, and the reason we called my first company Hugh, our slogan with Hugh, which sort of permeates everything I do, our slogan is "Get Back to Human." Hmm. And the reason we chose that slogan and why everything I do has the word human in it is that when you do enough research, you realize that we don't live in a way that is consistent with how we evolved. And a big part of why we are so sick today, both physical health and mental health, is because of that mismatch between the way in which we evolved over several million years and the way we live today. And so HumanCo is really meant to be a singular company that has all these different brands and companies where consumers can look at everything we do and see the trust and see the authenticity and not have to be skeptical or nervous, because we do live in a time where I think consumers should be skeptical, and it's very treacherous navigating today's world of consumption. Hmm. And so that was the basis of HumanCo. And I, as you know, I used to be in finance. I was a hedge fund manager for about 21 years. And I felt that while that was a really rewarding and interesting and lucrative career, I felt that my life's calling was really around helping people. And it was around trying to make it easier to live a healthier life, because it's just so difficult. And we're also at this tipping point in time where I think we really need to question the way we're living so that we can get back to a place where people are fulfilled, happy, and healthy.
And so that's an amazing story, and it all sounds good. But like you say, you were in hedge fund for 20 years, and you're extremely successful. So how can you say that it's not profit maximizing? I mean, isn't that kind of woke? And I'm playing devil's advocate, but like, how do you stay in business? How do you stay in business if you're not trying to make any money?
Well, to be clear, we are trying to make money, Jeff, but it's I could be doing things that make a lot more money than what we're doing. I mean, selling junk food, for example, is far more lucrative and profitable, mm-hmm, than selling organic food that's sourced from farms where the animals are treated respectfully and sustainably. And so we're definitely not a charity, but if you think about it as a spectrum where on one end of the spectrum, think of just pure profit harming the earth. Think of like a coal company, mm-hmm. or certain forms of oil and gas that are, or think about companies like Monsanto or companies that are producing toxic chemicals or plastics or things like that. That would be one end of the spectrum. Very lucrative, very bad for the planet, very bad for people, makes a lot of money. On the other side of the spectrum, you have pure charity. Mm-hmm. And there's many, many wonderful charities that have no hope ever of making any profits. And there is a very wide distance between those two poles. And so our goal is to sit somewhere, I don't know exactly if it's in the middle or it's a little more charitable, but in the same way that electric vehicles 10, 15 years ago were extremely non-profitable, mm-hmm. there has to be somebody in every industry that's trying to change the game to better humanity. There has to be somebody or some investors or some group that are willing to bear some significant losses for some period of time to prove to the world that this is a better way of doing things and effectively subsidizing the future. And I am the largest investor in HumanCo. I've put more money into HumanCo than anyone else has. And part of it is philanthropy, mm-hmm. because I believe that we have to demonstrate to the world and to consumers that this kind of food not only tastes better, mm-hmm. It's not just like health food that isn't enjoyable to consume, but not only does it taste better, but it's so much better for you and your family and the planet. But it comes with a catch. And the catch is something that is controversial, and I don't think it should be controversial, which is to do things better in terms of care, of how you source the ingredients, how you treat the farms, how you treat the farmers, how you treat the animals, how you make the food, how you produce the food. Those things all cost more money mm-hmm. than doing it in a hyper-processed, hyper-chemical, hyper-laboratory-based method. Mm-hmm. And we in this country, and I don't think most of it came from malice. I think most of it just came from simple profit maximization, is that we, for better or for worse, have gotten to a point where we have become obsessed, and we have become used to as a population to hyper processed cheap food. Mm. And when you are confronted or seafood that's a little more expensive, for many people, it's off-putting because mm-hmm. they're used to the super cheap food. But what consumers don't realize is that you always get what you pay for. Mm-hmm. And if you consume too much hyper-processed cheap food, you pay for it in the long run. You pay for it through your health. You pay for it through damage to the environment. And you ultimately are paying far, far more in the long run. And so I believe that what we're doing is we're investing for the future, but it's definitely not nearly as profitable as if we were selling cheap junk food.
Yeah, and I love your mission so much, and I'm right in the target market. You know, I need to eat better, and I'll get back to that in a minute. So, you know, part of this for me, this interview is so educational, but I've discovered in general, I can learn a lot about leaders like yourself by asking about their formative years. So let's go way back to your childhood. You didn't really hang out with a great crowd as a kid, did you?
I it's funny. My parents have revisionist history memory about my childhood. But I was not an exemplary student, and I was not an exemplary kid growing up. I grew up in a very small neighborhood, you know, that didn't have lines on the street. We were definitely closer to farms than we were to a city. And it was also a time, and we're probably similar ages, which was before, you know, most of the technology we value today, before internet or, you know, computers, et cetera. And I later learned that I and it was at a time when kids, especially in this region or areas of the country, if kids had learning differences or sort of neuro differences, they were never diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And I had severe ADHD as a kid. Mm-hmm. I had a very difficult time learning things that I didn't like. But I also had a very easy time learning things that were interesting to me, which as a kid were things like video games, and experimenting with some things that are now considered quite unsavory. But, you know, I liked playing with fire. I liked building weapons. I didn't like hurting anybody or hurting anything, but I was always fascinated by things that were destructive. You know, and we did a lot of risk seeking activities, my friends and I, from racing go-karts, you know, to lighting tennis balls on fire with gasoline and having a catch and those sort of things. And so I definitely had some brushes with the law, early, never actually got arrested or anything, but, looking back on my childhood, when I tell some of my friends who know me now, they can't believe that that's the way I used to be.
Tell me, what was that story that I heard from someone about a pellet gun, or someone you volunteered to be shot by a pellet gun?
Yeah, that was like one of my kind of Darwin Award moments. I still have the scar to prove it. I had these two neighbors that were about 4 or 5 years older than me. They were brothers. And as any young boy probably has, I looked up to these two kids. I was probably 7 or 8 at the time. They were probably 12 and 14, respectively, at the time. And they were also hooligans. And they had a pellet gun that they had just gotten. And we also were never supervised by our parents, you know, in this era. We would just kind of hang out in the backyard at people's houses. And they wanted to do target practice, and they had asked me if I would hold up a piece of paper with my hand in the air, and they would try to shoot a hole through the paper from, you know, maybe 20 or 30 yards away. Now, mind you, I was wearing no protective goggles or anything. I think I was in second grade, and I held up the piece of paper. They took a few shots. And on one of the shots, thank God I was wearing a winter coat at the time that was quite thick. I felt something hit me in the chest. I fell over, obviously ran away crying. And when I went home and took off all my layers of clothing, there was a pellet that was lodged in my rib cage through the skin, but you could see it. So it didn't actually go into the rib cage. And it was right where my heart is. And I think had it been summer, I think it would have probably killed me. And you would think that would have scared me away from playing with guns and weapons after that. And in fact, it actually made me more interested in them, not less.
It's amazing. I mean, tell me more about ADHD, you know, when you're a child. How did you experience that, and how did you cope with it?
It was, you know, it's funny. I've done a lot of therapy and I've done a lot of reflection on what I experienced as a kid. I had two related conditions. One was sort of uncontrolled anxiety, which I didn't realize was anxiety until much later in my life, where I would get fully paralyzed when something felt very nerve-wracking. And I did a lot of sport as a kid, and it typically came out during sport. And so my coaches and my father and my friends just thought it was like a form of what they called kind of choking under pressure. Mm-hmm. Which I later learned what I had was far, far more severe than just choking.
When you say you froze, what does that mean? And like, give me an example in a sport where you froze.
Well, there was a time, it was my first really, really salient memory. I was trying out for a little league baseball team in front of a big crowd. and where the coach was hitting fly balls to kids in the field, and you had to catch the balls to sort of make the team. And a lot of people were watching me. I caught the first couple balls, and then on like the third ball, I missed it. And I was looking at my father, and I was looking at the crowd, and for some reason I got very, very upset and nervous for missing the ball. And then I felt this just sort of flood happen, and I couldn't move my entire body. I was literally frozen on the field. I couldn't raise my arms. I didn't know what was happening to me. I was probably a similar age to the Pelican story. I was probably 7 or 8. And my father had to run out to the field and actually pull me off the field because I started crying. And I didn't know what was happening to me. And that happened to me many times. I became a competitive tennis player. And then in college, I was a Division I college squash player. And there were times during very, very high impact or high sort of reward competitions where there was a lot at stake, where I would feel the paralysis come. And I had to figure out ways to try to, and again, this is before I knew some of the modalities and methods like deep breathing and meditation. But I kind of figured it out on my own that through breathing and through visualization, I could kind of make the paralysis go away. But it took, you know, it took several minutes, sometimes 5 or more minutes.
You know, you're a kid and you're literally frozen, and there wasn't that much research on it, much less, you know, some of these techniques for dealing with it. You say you had to figure it out yourself. What does that mean? And how does a kid figure it out for themselves how to deal with it?
You know, in some ways, I really am grateful that I figured out a bunch of, you know, you can call them hacks, of both how I dealt with my ADHD and how I dealt with my anxiety. I didn't know of any books. I didn't know that I had something really, quote, wrong with me. It was just through a lot of trial and error, because I loved being an athlete. And so I had to figure, but there were times that I lost matches because of this. There were times it took far longer to sort of deal with the anxiety. But I noticed also that it was related to how well I slept. If I was sleep deprived, I was more likely to have it. I definitely noticed my breathing made a big difference. And I also noticed that preparation made a big difference for me. So the more, it actually forced me to practice a lot more, because the more things became muscle memory for me and the more prepared I felt, the less triggered I would be if I felt like it was about to come on. You know, my brain would sort of say, like, you got this, you know, it happened a lot when I was serving in competitive tennis matches, where if I had practiced enough serving, my brain would sort of remind itself that, like, you got this, you know how to serve, like, you don't have to, like, let because it would snowball on itself when I would start to get a little nervous, like, oh no, here it comes. And so I had to sort of figure out ways to stop it in its tracks. And there was a great documentary that came out a few years ago about another very accomplished tennis player in the late 90s named Marty Fish. And Marty Fish was Andy Roddick's roommate and his hitting partner. And Marty, I think at his peak, was the top 15, top 10 in the world. And the whole documentary is about how he had uncontrolled anxiety and didn't know it until, you know, like 5 years into professional tennis. And watching that documentary was actually really helpful for me, because the other thing that was really hard growing up like this, and then we can get into the ADHD stuff, but sure, it was before the internet. So I didn't have a lot of resources to be able to know that there were other people like me. And so one of the most difficult things for me about growing up with these two differences was I felt very alone. And I rarely came across people that had similar issues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was maybe one time I was also an actor until I went to college, and not a professional one, but you know, I was regularly the lead in our school plays, and I was in every play that we had, you know, from elementary school through middle school through high school. And so miraculously, I never had stage fright, which was really bizarre. Yes. But I met people in acting who did have stage fright. And when they would describe what they felt on the stage, it felt like what I felt when I was competing athletically. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I actually felt some sense of belonging when I would meet those folks.
But it's so strange that you didn't have stage fright. You know, why do you think you did it?
Yeah, it's really odd. I don't know. I loved performing in front of people. I think the acting was such a great set of training for me, mm-hmm. because it also told me how to speak in public. It taught me how to think on the fly. There were times, obviously, that I forgot my lines and I had to improvise. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why I didn't have stage fright. Mm-hmm. Whereas I had performance based anxiety with things like athletics.
Interesting. All right, so let's go back to the ADHD.
I don't think I fully knew that I had it until 12 years ago, and mm-hmm. I'm 46. Mm-hmm. And some of it has come out as I have two children. Both of them have different forms of ADHD.
And how old?
My daughter is 14 and my son is 9.
Okay.
And there's many, many different flavors of ADHD. And I think a lot of scientists and psychiatrists and psychologists are now recognizing that there's no textbook case. It's really that people's brains work differently. And for me, I had one of the kind of very high functioning kinds where if I find things that I enjoy, which again, when I was young, were very limited subjects. But if I find things that I enjoy, I can hyper-focus. Mm-hmm. And by hyper-focusing, it allows me to be totally consumed with something that I'm enjoying, mm-hmm. and get into a really deep flow state. Mm-hmm. And it also has allowed me, and I've had a sort of photographic memory from when I was a small kid. And so in the areas that I really liked, teachers would notice and they would say, like, hey, this one little part of school you're like shockingly good at, but everything else, like, you can't sit still. And I had a really hard time reading. I found most reading really boring, and I didn't read a full book from beginning to end probably until I was 16 or 17 years old. I just thought, like, this is just the way I was. Mm-hmm. And when I started telling people about it much later in life, when I became less ashamed of who I was, people would say, Jason, you had like a real learning disability. And again, never diagnosed. Nobody ever talked about it. And I had a couple teachers so middle school was easy for me because, like, we really didn't have homework. And just like my intellect got me by. But then I went to a very rigorous, difficult high school, and it required a lot of studying, a lot of reading. And I had a very difficult time my freshman and sophomore year of high school. And I had a couple teachers, my first English teacher, freshman year, who's no longer with us. Mm-hmm. But one day after, you know, a couple months into school, I was having a very hard time. He said, can I see you after class? And I was very scared because I always got in trouble and I thought I was in trouble again. And he pulled me aside and he said, after all the other kids had left, he said, Jason, I see that you learn differently than most of these other kids. And I see a lot of greatness in you. I'd like to help you figure out how to channel your energy and teach you how to be good at this, because I have a similar learning style. This is what the teacher told me. He said, I have a similar learning style to you, and I think you can be amazing, but you're going to have to work with me. And other than my parents, nobody had ever said anything like that to me. And I had just deep self-loathing and deep shame about all my, what felt like, deficiencies at the time. And he gave me confidence, and he showed me how to work with my brain in a different way. And then there were two other teachers in that high school who did kind of the same thing in different subjects. And if it weren't for those three teachers, I wouldn't be the man that I am today.
So the first time this teacher pulls you aside and says, Jason, I'd like to work with you, how did you feel?
First, it was disbelief. First, it was, why me? I couldn't understand why this teacher had taken such an interest in me. I was very flattered. It felt really good also. And then it was really warming, for lack of a better word, to my heart. It really felt nice that someone saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. So it was a profound experience for me, that first episode with that teacher.
And was it one of the very first times in your life, aside from your parents, that you didn't feel as alone? Because he had said to you, you know, I actually learned the same way myself.
Yeah, for sure. One of the other difficult things that I had as a kid was I have very, very high empathy. And it's been a blessing and a curse over my life. It's been a blessing because I can read people very well. I can connect with people very well. But it's also been a curse because I feel everyone's pain. And I also am very introspective. And so it's very easy for me to see something is wrong. And so it was incredibly easy for me to see that I was different and I was not like the other kids. And that was very difficult for me because it exacerbated those feelings of loneliness because I could perceive so clearly how different I was. I care much more about what other people think than I probably should. I really want to help everybody, which again, these all sound like noble things, but they can be paralyzing and they can,
too much empathy in a way, you know, can cause you to be too compassionate. And sometimes not saying this about you, but then that can inhibit a leader from making the tough decisions, or especially around interpersonal decisions.
Oh, for sure. I've always had a very hard time letting people go, parting with people, firing people. I've always been someone historically, I've gotten much better at this, but in the early parts of my career, I would give people 3, 4, 5, 6 chances when they clearly were not a right fit. You know, I was nicknamed Mother Teresa at one of my jobs because I always tried to resuscitate people who were clearly not doing a good job. And I took it upon myself to really try to help people and mentor people, which again sounds like a great noble thing, but there are people that are very negative energy and what some people call energy vampires. And when you have very high empathy, you are much more susceptible to energy vampires because they can really, really take a lot out of you because you're giving them so much of what you have to try to help them. Yeah.
So would you call your extreme empathy almost a leadership imperfection in certain ways? Because it does sound so counterintuitive to think of it that way.
Yeah, for sure. It has definitely been an imperfection in certain ways. I think on balance, it's been more of a blessing than a curse, for sure. There have been a handful of people that I've mentored that most managers or bosses would have discarded that have become amazing in various ways. And I take a lot of pride in the fact that I've mentored and trained certain people that were probably broken in certain ways like I was. And I brought out the best in them in the same way that teacher brought out the best in me. But it's definitely a potential flaw that you have to be aware of because it's harder to make objective decisions when you have such high empathy.
So let's get back to the career. And Jason, I'm thanking you so much for being so vulnerable. But then it's college time. So you're leaving Connecticut How did you end up deciding where you wanted to go to college, and what was that like?
At that point in time, I was really fascinated with medicine and human biology and anatomy and nutrition. And even as a high school student, I was really interested in those areas. And I wanted to be pre-med. Mm-hmm. I had a very diverse background in high school between theater and tennis. My grades were not great. And I miraculously, for a variety of reasons, got into a college that I had no business getting into, which was the University of Pennsylvania, which everyone around me who sort of knew my resume at the time were shocked that I got into Penn. But certainly my college guidance counselor didn't think I had a shot. And I got in. I was super grateful. My parents were thrilled. And I enrolled pre-med and began on a course or a path of a pre-med program. And I had a very unusual lucky break. Hmm. And your life is defined by many of these kind of lucky breaks. And there's been movies and books on these kind of moments. There was a movie called Sliding Doors, where one thing could just change and your whole life changes. And I dislocated my shoulder late junior year of high school, and it kind of derailed my tennis career. And I was also very burnt out. And when I got to Penn, instead of playing tennis, I decided to try to play squash. The very quick version of it is there was a gentleman on my freshman hallway that was a squash recruit. He heard I was one of the tennis players. He asked if I would hit squash balls with him. We ended up playing, and he didn't beat me as badly as I would have thought he should have. And I loved the game so much, I naively went up to the coach and said, "Hey, I'm a tennis player. Do you think I could try out for the squash team?"
This was Penn. This was like one of the top squash teams in the country, right?
Yeah, it was a naively insane request. That was also one of my virtues that I had, even as a young kid, which was I always had this reality distortion field, similar to Steve Jobs, where I just sort of thought like anything was possible. Mm-hmm. And I told him I was in great shape. I was going to work hard. I was very good with hand-eye kind of racket sports. And he said, "Look, kid, if you can make it through my preseason, which is very, very difficult, I'll save you a spot on the junior varsity team and we can see if we can turn you into a squash player." And because of that decision, I had to take the Wharton version, which is the business school of the University of Pennsylvania. And for those of your listeners that don't know, the Wharton School, when I was there, I think it might still be the case, is the top undergraduate business school in the country. And it's also the most difficult school in terms of academic credentials to get into in the country. Mm-hmm. More difficult than MIT, Stanford, or Harvard. And everyone had warned me about taking the Wharton version of econ. I was supposed to take the College of Arts and Sciences version of econ. Mm-hmm. But because of my athletic schedule, I could not take the regular version of econ, and I had to go into the lion's den with the smartest kids in the country. And I was still deeply insecure about myself. Mm-hmm. I still didn't think I had any business being at this school, never mind being in Wharton. And in the Wharton econ, there was a curve where only the top 10% could get an A, regardless of what happened. And long story short, when I was studying for econ, it came to me like a second language. And I didn't know why. I would read it once and I would remember everything. And I ended up getting the highest score in the class on the first exam without really studying. And I had never been in a position where I felt that. And here I was, it felt like it was a movie, and it felt like I was being like punked. It didn't feel like actual life. And there was a kid who was sitting behind me who saw my grade, and it was a class of like 200 kids. It was one of those big lecture halls. And there was a kid sitting behind me And he saw that I got the highest score, and he goes, "That's the kid who got the highest score in the class." And
so when he says that, were you ashamed or proud?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. It was a really weird feeling. I wasn't even in, I went to a high school with 200 kids in my class, and I wasn't even in the top 50 in my high school class. And here I was getting the highest grade in the hardest school in the country. And so I didn't even know how to process it. But what happened was, after maybe 5 minutes of blushing and feeling all this weird emotion of like, is this even possible? What's going on? I realized, like, maybe I have something in me that I can do this, and I'm going to now apply myself, and I'm going to try, and I'm not going to be that underachiever that everyone told me for my whole youth that I was the underachiever. And I didn't want that feeling to end. And I decided at that moment, I was going to apply myself and see where it took me.
So was it a similar feeling as when the high school teacher took you aside and tried to help you learn?
Yeah, but like on steroids, because when the high school teacher said it to me, it was a subjective comment from a guy that maybe liked me. This was like an objective piece of data. Yeah, like this was bizarre. Like I could not believe that this was really happening. And, you know, look, it was a very positive thing in some ways, but it also was a very negative thing. Because it taught me some lessons as I got better and better at figuring out how to work with my brain. It taught me some lessons that ultimately led to some severe mental health issues that I've had for, you know, most of my adult life.
And I want to talk about that in a second, but one other class at Penn that's interesting that I remember you talking about, chess. What was this weird chess class, and what did that teach you about, you know, leveraging your brain and thinking and business?
Yeah, that was probably my most formative, instructive life class of the whole university. It was an elective class. You had to apply to get into it. And it was taught by a former Russian international master, which is the level below grandmaster, a really accomplished, interesting guy. And the premise of the class was how to use chess and other games, but really chess, as a metaphor for life. But it was a very, very cerebral class about decision-making, probabilities, game theory. But the premise of it was, a chessboard is what's called a deterministic game, where there's even though it's almost incalculable, there is a finite number of moves, and there's no randomness in chess. Whereas in a game like poker, there's imperfect information and there's also randomness. And the premise of the class was that prior to the 1800s, all chess was played in a certain format, which is called combinational chess. And combinational chess is what most regular people play, which is you think about chess in terms of certain number of moves ahead. If I do this, Jeff will do this, and then I'll counter with this move, and then Jeff will probably counter with these two moves, and it's very much tit for tat. And there was a child prodigy by the name of Paul Morphy who came along in the 1800s, who was 21 when he became the world chess champion. And he pioneered a different style of chess called positional chess, which is now the style of chess that all top chess players use, where you're not trying to think just in moves ahead. You're thinking about how you position your chessboard to maximize the probability of success in terms of defense, if you have to play defense, but to also maximize the probability of success in terms of offense, where you don't necessarily know what's going to happen next, but you've positioned your board in such a way that it has the maximum number of options to do the right thing. And that metaphor resonated immensely with me in terms of life, because I'm a very probabilistic thinker. I've always loved probabilities and numbers. And it made it clear that so many lessons that we have been told for millennia around, you know, there's a famous expression of hard work brings luck, or the harder I work, the luckier I become, or don't burn your bridges. These are all expressions that are related to positional chess, which is you want to set up your life and your career in a way where you maximize the odds of, if you're dealt with adversity, you can deal with it in a number of ways. And if you're presented with opportunity, you have a lot of different ways to capture that opportunity because of how you've arranged your life chessboard, if that makes sense.
It does. So it's not just hard work. It's hard work with a purpose so that you create more optionality.
Correct.
And what about if I combine that, you know, this positional chessboard thinking with empathy? How does empathy play into chess?
Well, a lot of what my father taught me and a lot of how I've governed my life is around relationship building and around forming relationships, both for the objective benefit of it, but also for the spiritual element of having really good, loving relationships. Because there's both. And what I mean by that is there's certain people that are very Machiavellian, where they're very focused on relationships for the express means to an end. And they think, if I have these relationships, maybe these guys or these women or these people are going to open doors for me. But it feels very transactional. And people can sense that. And people don't like those people, generally speaking. And then there's people who are always givers. And sometimes you can give too much, where you don't stand up for yourself enough and you're helping, you know, too much. But what I have found is that the givers actually tend to benefit more in life than the transactional folks, because you may do people favors. I've done people many, many favors over 25, 30 years without an express or explicit goal of, what are you going to do back for me? And there have been times in my life where I forgot about somebody, literally, like 15 years later, somebody reaches out to me and says, hey, I remembered when you helped me with XYZ. I want to introduce you to somebody. And that person ends up becoming someone really important or meaningful to me. And so the empathy, I think, is critical for how you choose to position your chessboard. Because if you're too transactional, too Machiavellian, too mercenary, you're not going to position that board in a way that is optimal.
That's so interesting. And, you know, in your own words, you became a little like Bradley Cooper in that movie Limitless. You felt like you could take a mysterious little pill that allowed you to use 100% of your brain so that you could learn anything and everything. So this kind of limitless mentality kind of took over your life for a while.
Yep.
Tell me about this, and, you know, why was that a double-edged sword?
I'd say up until about 5-6 years ago, I was very secular, not spiritual. I was an atheist, and I lived fully in my intellect and in my brain. And when I figured out how to use my brain in the way I could, and in many ways, I've been blessed with genetic gifts for how my brain works. But I had hacked my brain in a way where I learned how to hyper-focus on whatever I wanted. And so those skills that I had in my youth, where I could hyper-focus on a couple things, I figured out a way to be able to hyper-focus on anything. And once I could do that, I was able to learn and absorb and process information at a speed that was very unusual, which allowed me to progress in my career much faster. It allowed me to make a lot of money. It allowed me to learn a tremendous amount from books and podcasts and movies. But because it was sort of a self-fulfilling machine, it gave me what some psychiatrists would call a God complex, where you literally think you can do anything. And when you live too much in your brain and in your intellect, your body starts to suffer because you're not experiencing love, connection. You're not experiencing joy, fulfillment. And a lot of the things that I thought were, quote, a waste of time, because I was on this sort of hell-bent mission to just become this sort of productivity machine. And because my brain worked so well, I never wanted to stop it. In some ways, it's sort of like, you know, the fable of King Midas, where, you know, he wished he could, everything he touched turned to gold, you know, and then you realize like, oh shit, you really don't want just this. And I started getting really sick in my early 20s, because there's a lot of hypotheses as to how it happened. If you're a true scientist, you would say that it was just inflammation and autoimmune disease. Some of my more spiritual mentors, you know, believe that if you live too much in your intellect and you don't give your body and your spirit what it needs to thrive, that your body kind of self-destructs. I do. And there's overwhelming evidence that mental problems manifest physically. Overwhelming evidence. Yeah, indisputable. I mean, there's a very famous book that's now become super famous called The Body Keeps the Score, which is more about trauma. But it's one of the top selling books now, but it's related, which is that there's certain things that live in your brain. Whether it's a very traumatic incident that happened to you, or it's something that you're ruminating about, or something that's really bothering you, that manifests through you physically. And your mind and your body are deeply interconnected. Even if you're not someone who's spiritual, it's just a factual thing that we've seen over time. And I was going blind. My hair was falling out in clumps. I had all sorts of skin diseases, including psoriasis, eczema. I fell into a deep depression for the first time in my early 20s. I've struggled with depression for probably 30 years, and I never fully knew what it was. And because I was going so fast all the time, and objectively, it looked like I was living a good life. Mm-hmm. What most people value in today's society, you know, or how you look on the outside, you know, or do you have a good job? Do you have a good family? Are you married? Are you making money? All these things. And so objectively, it looked like I was living a, quote, good life. But inside, I was broken. And my health kept giving me all sorts of very bizarre problems. And I was so ashamed about even talking about how I felt on the inside, because people would look at me and say, how dare you complain? Like, look at all these blessings you have. And ironically, that made it worse for me, because then I felt even more alone. Like, I couldn't talk to anybody because they would basically chastise me for complaining when I've obviously had many, many blessings given to me in my life.
Is that when you started therapy? I mean, so what did you do? You felt ashamed and alone. And when you talked about it, or at least when you tried to talk about it, you felt more alone. So what did you do?
I'd say the early part of my hero's journey, I've had many moments where I've been in the abyss and I've come out stronger. And the first big one was when I was 23 and when I was going blind and I was so sick. I used my kind of problem solving intellect to cure my disease. You know, like similar to the typical hero's journey, was I visited lots of people when I was sick. I visited doctors. I visited integrative people who are now called functional medicine doctors. I talked to various psychiatrists. And I took nuggets of wisdom from each of them, but nobody had kind of the answer. And I kind of assembled a mosaic that allowed me to figure out that I needed to reduce my inflammation, and I needed to figure out a way to do that. And part of that was getting out of my own head. And one of my first psychiatrists basically told me to engage, and he gave me homework. And he basically said, Jason, you are a productivity machine. And I am going to give you homework where you have to spend 2 hours a day on an activity that has no purpose and has no end goal, which they now call kind of in the biohacking community, ATLIC activities, which are activities that are meant for the activity itself, where you're not trying to get better and you're not trying to like have a goal.
Did you think that was a weird assignment, or were you?
It was such a weird assignment. And the reason I knew I was actually really sick is because I had such a hard time doing it. And he wanted me to watch, and this was at a time when that show Sex and the City was on. He wanted me to watch Sex and the City, which of course I thought was a colossal waste of time. He wanted me to play video games where I wasn't trying to like win the game and like get better at it. And he wanted me to, you know, have a meal with a friend where there was no benefit other than enjoying the friend's company, right? Like I couldn't do a deal. I couldn't learn from the friend. It was just like hanging out.
You basically just described a normal life of 90% of the people I know.
I know. And by the way, that's how I was as a kid. But because of how ashamed I was as a kid of what I thought I was, and then all of a sudden it felt like I got this kind of gift where I became, you know, like really smart and I could use my brain again. I felt like I had to bury that kid. And now I just wanted to be like a warrior. And by burying that kid, I also buried all things that is part of the human condition. And that is also what made me so sick.
So how did you get better?
It was a lot of things, but my real saving grace was my wife. And, you know, there were a lot of small things that I changed. Obviously, my diet. I made exercise a critical part of my daily routine. But I actually had the maturity when I was 25. I met my wife. I had dated, you know, a bunch of women before that, but didn't think I wanted to get married. And there was something in my wife that after spending a few weeks with her, she was very compatible for me. And I fell in love with her, but I knew that getting married and having kids was at odds of my kind of megalomaniac desire to conquer the world. And I realized that if I don't surround myself with love and connection, I'm probably going to not make it to the age of 40. And so part of it was I had to force myself into a relationship that really fed the things that I think all humans need. And I found someone that and I didn't know at the time, to be clear. Like, I didn't know she was my soulmate at the time. I didn't know she was going to be my savior. But I had enough of an inkling that I needed this so that I didn't basically end up in a gutter.
Was she a little afraid at the time because you were, you know, living inside your own brain and you were this megalomaniac? I mean, why did she stick with it?
You know, it's a really good question. We've had a lot of conversations about my metamorphosis. And I think there were parts of me that she had in her also. There's an expression in therapy that trauma finds trauma. And she didn't have nearly the degree of derangement that I had, but she was a hyper overachiever herself. She actually went to Wharton also. And, you know, she worked her tail off to the point where she burnt out, and she had a workaholic father who clearly I partially reminded her of. And I think we had some very similar wirings where we wanted to help each other. And I think we've helped each other grow immensely. I've been with my wife now 21 years. And we're totally different people now than we were when we met. And we've really helped each other evolve and become much better, more balanced people.
A beautiful story. And what about your kids? How do you talk to them about things that you suffered with, like the ADHD and maybe other things too?
It's really difficult, but we're very open and transparent with them. They have many of my blessings and my curses, which you know, when I was their age, I didn't know what to do with them, and it created a lot of anxiety and a lot of sadness and loneliness in me. And we're trying to be much more explicit and transparent about what I went through. I tell them lots of stories about my youth, and I and they have many of the same things. And what I've been able to do, which has been a saving grace for me, and I encourage all parents to do this, because I was ashamed and I came up in a culture or an environment where talking about your feelings, particularly for men and for boys, was not acceptable. We have really taught our children to be open about their feelings and their emotions, and that those emotions are okay, whatever they are. And we try to help them work through it and not bury it. And part of my difficulties and kind of traumas that I went through as a kid were because I buried everything and I bottled up everything and I didn't want to talk about it. And by allowing our kids to express their emotions, they realize whatever they're going through is part of the human condition and that there's ways to address it. And so when my son complains or laments that he has learning differences from a lot of his peers, I talk about what my learning differences were and how it's not a disorder, that it's actually, in many ways, it's a gift. And that I show him that there are a lot of very, very famous and accomplished people who have Asperger's or had ADHD or had dyslexia, and that those were gifts in certain ways that allowed them to accomplish whatever they did.
Yeah, and even the name of this podcast, Imperfect Leaders, is on purpose. You articulate your crucible moments so beautifully. I mean, do you think all leaders or perhaps all people in general should go through the exercise of thinking about and articulating their crucible moments and how it has impacted their core values and, you know, their beliefs and mission as a human being?
For sure. I think what's made me a better leader and mentor is that I have had severe adversity over and over and over again. And the best leaders I know have all had severe adversity throughout their life, and they've overcome it, and they recognize that you cannot become good at anything without adversity, but you have to at least be able to reflect on it and reflect why it was painful, what you learned from it. And I think one of the things that's difficult for certain leaders is to acknowledge the pain when they're in it. And you will learn from your mistakes much faster if you acknowledge how painful it is when you're in it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll repeat the mistakes over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so I think being very reflective and being able to talk about it and being able to normalize that failure is normal and part of the human condition. In fact, you can't be good if you don't fail a lot. I think that's a necessary element to what makes a good leader, because then when they're training or mentoring or they're trying to instill values, they come from a place where they've been there.
And now I have such a good understanding of your leadership journey. Can I just go for a few minutes and go full circle back to nutrition and health?
Yeah, sure.
You talked about Humanco, which I love. I'm now your biggest fan in the world. But how can you make your mission more accessible to even more of the country, you know, to people who would really benefit from it, like marginalized people in underserved communities where there is no real access to healthy food? And, you know, as you know better than most, it's a vicious circle. It's a poor diet, then health issues, and they have poor health care, and that leads to mental health problems. And then they eat even worse because it feels good. So is there anything, you know, that you can do, or that anyone listening to this podcast that are themselves young, up-and-coming, mission-driven leaders, you know, what can they do and how should they be thinking about it? And what are you doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I definitely haven't solved this riddle. And it does. This will take a village to do this. It might be time for another podcast to talk about all this, but there are a lot of variables that went into how we got here as a society. I think there's two aspects of access, in quotes. There's the literal accessibility of the food. Like, is it within 10 miles, a 10 mile radius of where you live, you know? And then there's the price access of the food. And they're actually separate issues. And the physical access of the food, I think, is a much harder problem to solve, and requires a lot of groundswell and a lot of coordination with more mission-driven companies who are not just profit maximizing, because for the convenience store type of stores, the 7-Elevens of the world, they make the most money on things like soda and Twinkies, and they make less money on healthier food. And so there's a real profit maximizing motive for why shittier, longer shelf life, junkier food is in airports, gas stations, convenience stores, et cetera, because it's actually more profitable. Mm-hmm. The second point, which is controversial but should not be, is it's not that a lot of people think that healthy, you have to be wealthy to eat healthy. Mm-hmm. And that is a misnomer. And the reason it's a misnomer is because if you look at the demographic data and you look at the spending data of all socioeconomic demographics going down to the poverty line, they are still spending a significant portion of their disposable income, if they even have even a little, on things like soda, beer, cigarettes, even things like Nikes, Starbucks, you know, even an iPhone. There have been studies that have been done at nutrition schools that show that anyone who has the means to afford a smartphone, which is 99% of this country, mm-hmm. means that you have the means also to spend a couple dollars a day extra on the quality of your food. Now, that might mean that you don't subscribe to Netflix and Spotify and all these streaming services. It might mean that you buy one fewer pair of Adidas or Nikes. It might mean that you don't get a Frappuccino once a week. But the math is there. So it's not about wealth. It's only a couple dollars a day that can make a huge difference. But then it comes back to education, which is why would they do that? And that is something that is a real difficult challenge to convince people about long run versus short run. Because the short run of a Twinkie or a sugar-laden donut, it tastes better than eating probably a salad with chicken on it. And that is preying off of our human impulses in the same way that drugs prey or alcohol prey off of our human impulses. And I think that we have to, as a society, and there are other societies that do this, by the way, Italy and France are two notable ones, where those two countries, which are steeped in a culture of food and farming and culture, they have disdain for ultra cheap processed food, to the point where those countries spend twice as much as a percentage of their paycheck. So normalized for paycheck level, so it doesn't matter what income level you are, they spend twice as much as a percentage of their paycheck on food that we do as Americans. And that's because they value food more than they value some of these other material things. And I think we have to change the conversation that there should be some pride and there should be some value in rewarding better practices, better farming, better animals, better conditions, not destroying the environment. It does require a sense of education to say, hey, instead of spending $2 on that cheeseburger, you should ask, how is it possible to make a $2 cheeseburger? And you should actually be revolted, because it shouldn't be possible to make a $2 cheeseburger. And you should ask the better question, which is, why is a fruit cup at McDonald's more expensive than a cheeseburger?
And since you brought up McDonald's, you know, I realize the people who eat at McDonald's three times a week are probably never going to eat a true food. But if you could make, you know, if you and Dr. Weil and Oprah could wave a magic wand, you know, what are a couple of the systemic changes you'd want to see in the way, you know, in terms of the way people eat?
So the first thing I would say is just is a basic education. I mean, it's amazing to me that we teach things in school like STEM, and we don't teach people how to read an ingredient label. And you know, we interact with food anywhere from 3 to 10 times a day, every person in the country. And we know less about food than we know about like toothpaste or brushing our teeth. And it's crazy. Talk about like life skills. Yeah. We need to teach people the basics of when you see an ingredient label that's 80 ingredients long, right? If you look at like Totino's pizza rolls, for example, which is one of the foods I love to hate on, their pepperoni flavor has 90 ingredients in it. And it has imitation cheese in it. It says imitation cheese. And it has 25 chemicals in it, many of which are banned in foreign countries. And we allow this. And most people eat food without reading ingredient labels. And so the first thing I would say is just basic proficiency and literacy in how to read an ingredient label and how to say, like, I don't recognize what these things are. I probably shouldn't put those in my body. Because if you don't recognize an ingredient, your body probably doesn't either. Mm-hmm. And so that would be like the first thing I would say. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I would say is just start asking more questions. Like, where is this made? How is this made? Who's behind this? You know, what's the motive in making this product? Because there's the regulations in the US are simply too loose. The lobbyists are too powerful. And we are literally poisoning our population. I know this sounds sensationalist, but if you look at people's health, you look at chronic disease, you look at the obesity epidemic, all these things are black and white. It's not even debatable. And so to me, a lot of it is just basic proficiency about, you know, buying more fresh fruits and vegetables, learning how to cook at home a little bit more. I know it's inconvenient. And then choosing, instead of spending that marginal $5 or $10 a week, mm-hmm. on the beer, on the cigarettes, on the soda, take that and buy food that comes from places where the people that made it are trying to make you better and trying to make the world a better place. Because the invisible hand works, and the more you reward people who engage in better practices, the more the world will change.
I'm so embarrassed to admit it, but I still eat too much sugar, and I still am sort of addicted to Diet Coke. I mean, what can I do individually to wean myself off of Diet Coke? And why hasn't someone come up with a decent, healthy substitute for it? Or is there one?
There is. There is. In fact, is there are... But it's more expensive than Diet Coke.
That's fine. What is it?
Yeah. So there's two healthy soda companies that have become quite popular. I'm indirectly an investor in one. One's called Olipop, mm-hmm. Olipop, and the other's called Poppy, Poppi.
It doesn't have that weird aftertaste, does it?
No, neither of them do, which is why they've become quite popular. In fact, we sell Olipop at True Food Kitchen. Okay. We don't sell regular soda at True Food Kitchen. We sell Olipop. If you get the cola version from Olipop, and Olipop's everywhere now, so you can find it. You'll find that it's very satisfying. It's 25 calories a can. It has 50 milligrams of caffeine, so you're going to get the caffeine that you need. You know, part of your Diet Coke addiction is probably the caffeine. There's many sources or healthier sources of caffeine without the chemicals that come with Diet Coke. And then eventually, and a lot of people enjoy caffeine, you know, you're going to move to organic coffee. You'll move to green tea. You'll move to other sources of caffeine that don't have all the added chemicals, carbonation, et cetera. So there are a lot of alternatives for what your habits are. And with HumanCo, and this is an important sidebar, we chose, and we also did this with Hugh Chocolate, we have chosen categories of food that most people would call indulgent foods or comfort foods, mm-hmm. because these are categories that people love and they bring people joy. And if you try to change people's habits from eating really delicious, indulgent foods that are not good for you, and you try to get them to switch to salads, that's never happening. And the data shows it's not happening. Whereas if we can take someone like you and get you off of Diet Coke and move you to the Olipop Cola, that's a good first step. Mm-hmm. And so we created brands and have things in, you know, ice cream. We have Cosmic Bliss, which is a much healthier version than Ben and Jerry's, for Against the Grain, which is a grain and gluten-free pizza and bread company. It's a much healthier version than DiGiorno's or those other frozen pizzas. And Snow Days is a frozen, is an organic grain-free pizza bite that uses grass-fed dairy. That's a much healthier version than Totino's pizza rolls.
And that's the one where Scarlett gets her daughter to eat it happily.
Yes, correct. Okay. And you'll find that if you eat these, you're not going to feel like you're compromising on taste. You're not going to feel like, oh, I wish I had the real thing. What we make is the real thing. Ironically, what people have been consuming is a synthetic chemical laboratory version. 50 years ago, we didn't have all these chemicals. So like Coca-Cola wasn't that bad for you 50 years ago.
You know, to all the young leaders out there who share your vision and your values and maybe even your mission, how would you challenge them to make an impact in the world? You said earlier it takes a village. You know, what's your challenge to them?
My challenge would be, don't be conventional. You know, my whole life was unconventional. Initially, it was not by design, but you sort of realize that you can't be extraordinary if you do the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And to just question everything and to not and to be willing to take risks that make you happy about who you are and not necessarily risks just to get rich. Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to change. I mean, we're at a pretty scary point in time in the world. You see it with the global warming. You see it with all the bizarre weather things that have been happening, from the fires to the storms. You see it in human health. Like, it's staring us in the face. And you know, I'm not Mother Teresa. I'm not saying, you know, become a monk necessarily, although that's a noble pursuit if you want to. But there are ways to do well and do good at the same time. It's harder. It's definitely harder. But you know, I abandoned a very lucrative career to go into a career that's semi-philanthropic, because I got to the point where I look around and I'm just very upset with the status quo. And if not enough people are trying to change it, I raised my hand and said, I'm going to be one of the people who tries to help other people and tries to change it.
And if you tell them, you know, to be unconventional and take some risk, well, that's necessarily going to cause some failure and some shame, but what I'm getting from your journey is that's not necessarily a bad thing. And it's not sweeping it under the rug. It's dealing with it head on, exactly like how you're teaching your kids. So when the people that are being unconventional take these risks and they do fail, how should they deal with that?
I think if you view the journey as the goal, instead of the end as the goal, it's much easier to deal with the catastrophes. You know, I reframed it a long, long time ago, where I used to think in my early career that life was supposed to be smooth sailing. And once in a while, you'd have these kind of bad situations and you had to deal with them. And what I have learned is that it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Life is a series of catastrophes with short periods of smooth sailing. And if you accept that going into it, then you can enjoy the catastrophes because they just keep coming, and you just sort of view it like they're bumps on a road. And I think when you reframe it as that, then every time you have a failure, every time you have a setback, you view it as like, okay, this is part of the game. And it's much easier to get back up when you view it as an intrinsic element of the game, as opposed to something that's flukish.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to our audience around the world for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you have any questions or comments for our guests or want to attend private conversations and events, feel free to visit us at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we hope you'll join us next week.